This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shoma dar in qarn mo'jiza kardid, millat-e Iran millat-e mo'jiza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. And the expert I have to discuss this, as usual, on the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, is Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, good friend, academic scholar, and Islamic scholar as well. A very warm welcome to you, sir. Salam and hello.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we are looking at the Imam's will.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the analysis, if you like, the thinking behind why is it so essential that we Muslims must be united?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let's look at what he said.
Yes.
In this quote. Yes. Unfortunately, in the hands of conniving enemies and ignorant friends, the Holy Quran, this divine book that is empowered to decide man's destiny, has found no place anywhere except in graveyards and at gatherings of the dead, for the dead, although technically also of the dead.
Of the dead, of course, yes.
The instrument
Absolutely,
that
because,
was to
yeah,
unite Muslims and all mankind, the instrument that was to unite Muslims and all mankind.
Yes. And all mankind.
Listen, Imam is, you know, it's his last will. So he's being hardcore.
He's very hardcore.
He's not even...
And because when he says all mankind, of course the Quran is for all humanity, for
exactly.
all time.
Right.
Whether we are believers or not is immaterial.
Right. The instrument that was to unite the Muslims and all mankind and serve as the scripture for their lives and salvation has turned into an instrument of division and dispute among men, or it has left the arena entirely. We all witnessed that whoever spoke of Islamic rule or of politics, which is the major role of Islam and its prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or of the Quran and the Islamic traditions, was regarded as one who had committed a grave sin. The term ahund siyasi, political clergy, came to denote a profound obscurantist.
Right.
These circumstances still exist. In recent years, major satanic powers have, through their puppet regimes, undertaken to reprint and publish the Holy Quran, distorting sacred verses to serve their devilish ends. Such Qurans are published with attractive calligraphy and binding and are distributed everywhere with the aim of eventually removing the Holy Book from all scenes.
My goodness.
We all remember the Quran that Muhammad Reza Khan Pahlavi had printed. He succeeded in deceiving some people, including a few Muslim ahunds or preachers who, unaware of the aims of Islam, praised him for it. We note that each year, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, at that time it was King Fahd in Saudi Arabia, spends a good deal of wealth of the people in printing the Holy Quran and considerable publicity and propaganda material in support of the anti-Quranic ideas, propagating the baseless and superstitious cult of
Wahhabism.
Fahd abuses the Quran, urges negligent people and nations to side with the superpowers. He uses noble Islam and the Holy Book to destroy both.
Very interesting.
And let there be no doubt that, I'm saying this now, this is not a quote,
sure.
that it is exactly the same way today.
Exactly.
With Abdullah.
With Abdullah and Prince Bandar.
And whoever it is that's going to rule the Al-Saud, because
exactly.
Al-Saud look at Islam as an instrument to maintain
their
family
own
rule.
Power.
They don't really care about Islam.
No, they don't, because they burn the Qurans as well.
Right. We are proud, this is Imam, and I love this part, we are proud, and our dedicated nation is proud, that we adhere to the faith in which the Holy Quran speaks of the unity.
The unity, yes.
The unity of all Muslims and the oneness of mankind.
Oneness of mankind.
Because it's not just about
no.
unity of Muslims,
no.
it's the oneness of
mankind.
Mankind,
yes.
We are proud that our faith has retrieved the Quran from the cemeteries and has saved this holy book as man's prescription for freedom from all physical, mental, and intellectual bonds that push him deeper into slavery and nothingness.
Into non-existence.
We are proud to be followers of a religion whose founder has been designated by divine commandment, and in which Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam, this servant of God, free of all bonds and shackles of servitude and serfdom, has been appointed to deliver mankind from all the chains of slavery and enslavement. We are honored that the book Nahjul Balagha, which is next to the Quran, is man's great manuscript for salvation, moral and material existence, and the greatest instrument for just rule and government, and has our infallible Imam Ali as its author. Well, you know, what can I say? We see these things. There's other things he says here, which I think is very nice. Mm. And I'm reading this in the beginning, and then we're going to talk a little bit more, because I think, you know, his own words really
say it all.
Right. Mm. Our nation, indeed all Islamic nations, as well as the meek and oppressed, are pleased to see that their enemies, who are the enemies of Almighty God, of Islam and of the Holy Quran, are indeed savages, who do not desist from committing any criminal acts to promote their mean purposes, and who are unable to tell a friend from a foe in achieving treacherous goals. I think this would
reflect Syria very well.
With what's going on in Syria.
Syria, yeah. Very well.
Okay, now...
Savages.
Let's listen to this sentence.
Yeah.
This sentence that's going to come.
And digest that.
And let's just ponder on it.
The USA
is the foremost enemy of Islam.
Ah.
Period.
What's new?
It is a terrorist state by nature.
Ah, and they declared a war on terror, didn't they?
It is a terrorist state by nature that has set fire to everything, everywhere, and its allies. The internet and its allies. Everything, everywhere, and its allies.
Allies as well.
No, no. And its ally, international Zionism, does not stop short of any crime to achieve its base and greedy desires.
Yes.
Crimes that the tongue and the pen are ashamed to utter and write.
True.
The insane idea of a greater Israel urges them to commit any shameful act. The Islamic nations and the mustazafin, the weak and oppressed peoples of the world, are pleased to have Hussein of Jordan, a professional itinerant criminal, Hassan of Morocco, and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, fellows of Israel, as their enemies. The people are proud to have them as their enemies. These are criminals with Israel. These are co-criminals with Israel, and commit any act of treason against their own nations to serve the USA. We cheer to have Saddam the Afalaki as an enemy, whom friend and foe know to be a criminal, a violator of human rights and international laws, and whose betrayal of the people of Iraq and of the Persian Gulf Emirates has been no less than his betrayal of our country and people. We and the oppressed peoples of the world are delighted to be objects of criminal accusations by the superpowers through their international mass media under their control.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I mean, think about this, this is
right at the beginning. Well, you know,
I mean, think about all these people these Muslims who so desperately try to.
Yeah.
Oh, please love us.
Yes.
Oh, please, we're good.
We are good. We are nice.
Right.
We're peaceful.
He's saying we're proud.
Yeah.
We're delighted.
Yeah.
To be objects.
Objects.
Of criminal accusations.
Exactly, because it keeps us on the right path.
Well, I mean, I think it just you have to understand Islam.
Yes, this is it.
Right.
This is what we're talking about.
What can be a better source of pride? This is him speaking. What can be a better source of pride than the fact that the USA, with all its military might, its boastfulness, its claims, its mass media, and its allies among puppet regimes, has been so dumbfounded and disgraced in its dealings with the dauntless Iranian nation and the land of His Holiness Baghiyatullah.
Wonderful. Yeah.
That it does not know which way to turn and who to turn to. This is not the work of anyone.
This is not the work of anyone
or anything except divine assistance.
Divine assistance.
That has awakened nations. Islamic awakening?
Islamic awakening.
Particularly the Iranian Muslim nation, and has guided it from darkness into light, the light of Islam. And this is the final paragraph that I'm going to read. I now take this opportunity to advise the oppressed and noble nations, including our own, to stay firmly on this divine straight path that leads neither to the atheistic, mulhid, God-denying East, nor to the oppressive, idolatrous West, but to the path which Almighty God has decreed for us.
Exactly.
I further advise not to be negligent even for a single moment in being grateful for this blessing. Let no polluted hand of a superpower or its agents, whether domestic or foreign, affect your determination and will. Know that the angrier the Eastern or Western satanic powers get, the more proof it is for your divine support. And God shall reward and punish the deserving ones in the best fashion, in this and in the other worlds.
Oh,
and then he quotes, he quotes an ayah from Surah Mu'minin, verse 88. Truly he is the Lord of all blessing, and in his land lies dominion over all things.
Well, that, in a nutshell, says everything about the greatness of the Imam in terms of the fact of the understanding of Islam, because this has been a big, big problem for many centuries. And he's given us the path, if you like, the road to salvation, and telling us that in the circumstances we are now, and we are talking about 25 years on since he said those words, and we see the situation what it is, for what it is, and everything about it still is fresh. It's still, it's become crystal clear now. I mean, at that time when he was seeing those things, that wasn't clear. But now we see them, the savages for what they are, who is the real enemy of Islam. And for us, as he says, the greatest divine blessing for us is the fact that the more angrier they become with us, the better.
And, you know, I don't know. I think it really, you got to think about what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, you have to understand the nature of who they are.
Exactly.
We were
talking about that,
right,
in another program, that we must know our enemy.
Right. And he's talking about their terrorist state by nature.
Yeah, of course.
So
where are these human rights and all these other things they
then
talk about?
Then he's talking about the fact that, you know, we are delighted and it's a source of pride that they accuse us
of criminal.
And they call us names.
They call us
this
names.
This shows that
Islamophobia in Europe and whatever else you call it.
And he says the angrier that they get, and he's talking both Eastern and Western satanic powers, as he puts it.
Sure.
The more proof it is for your divine support. And this is something, you know, this is a higher...
This is Quranic, you know, this is the Quranic thinking.
And so this is the point we're trying to make with the listeners, and of course, in the first instance with ourselves.
Ourselves, yes.
You know, don't look at the minimum level of Islam.
Look at the
maximum level.
Look at the maximum, look at the ultimate.
Look at that hardcore level of it.
Hardcore.
I don't know. Well, you know, you can do it.
Yes.
You know.
It's not difficult because the prophets themselves are our examples.
Right. So the point is that,
peace be upon,
obviously, they're going to try to make you regret having gone this path.
Yes, they do, don't they?
Okay, shaitan, that's shaitan's job.
That's shaitan. He wants to make heaven look like hell.
Exactly.
And make
hell look like heaven.
Exactly.
And so the point is that, you know, I don't think we should be so worried that they call us names or terrorists or whatever, you guys are this or that. I mean, reality, everybody's seeing this now. Maybe at that time...
At that time, it wasn't clear.
Right. At that time, they were maybe able to manipulate matters more.
Sure, sure.
You know, again, the example of Syria is a very good one.
Very good. The savages are there.
Right. I mean, it's very clear who's being barbaric there.
Barbaric there, yes.
It's the Americans and the Israelis and the Saudis.
Cohorts with the Wahhabis.
Right.
Yes.
When, of course, the, you know, poodles from Europe, you know, going along.
Yeah.
And the ones who are actually fighting for unity, who are fighting to maintain, you know, peace and
stability
and civilization. Right? Because remember, barbarism is always as opposed to the civilized, right?
Of course
you have civilized and you have barbarians.
Barbarians. That's still true, right, since Roman days.
So I think it's safe to say that, you know,
Iran is at the forefront of civilization.
Of civilization in this matter.
Exactly. And this is what's eating away at them at the moment, because
we're not, we're
no,
supposed
because
to be
I tell, no, I'm only going to quote from, you know, their own experts. Even, you know, Professor Neil Ferguson, who's also an Oxford economist from Oxford.
Scottish.
He's not Scottish. He is Scottish. I beg your pardon. Sorry, mm-hmm. Mr. Ferguson. Anyway, he says, in his own words, that, you know, the West is in decline because of its paganism and its hedonism and the fact that it is corrupt beyond belief. And because of that, their decline is such that they have gone into the depths of barbarism. But they don't realize it until now, 25 years on, as we were talking about the occupation movement, the Occupy movement, we were looking at other protests elsewhere throughout Europe. Of course, the Islamic awakening is on the one hand. But when we put all that together, we see the truth ringing out of the Imam's words. That's exactly the situation that we've got now. That people have now realized that, wait a minute, these people who were professing civilization and human rights and all the rest of it are in cahoots with liberators, head choppers, who, you know, I mean, we saw that on the screens, you know, Christian priests in Syria with their heads being hacked off with a saw. And they think, that's okay. You tell me what the war on terror is all about.
Right. And I think the point that he's, Imam Khomeini is talking here too, he's speaking to Muslims.
He's speaking to Muslims.
He's saying to them, I mean, he says, obviously he's speaking to more than Muslims, but his main audience or the main people who are supposed to understand this are the Muslims. So it's, I think we have a problem in the Muslim world, is that we don't really go to the furthest extent that the Quran wants us.
Exactly. And the other
we're always trying to, like, you know, kind of make it sweeter and nicer and,
yeah,
you know, let's have a whole big spoon of sugar that so the medicine goes down, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But
that's not the point. The point is that, you know, it's not about in your heart. And this is a different issue than trying to, you know, deal diplomatically with your enemy or with people. That,
no, that's not what we're talking about.
You know, it doesn't mean that you go out and you are rude. But in your heart, okay, don't. You shouldn't care what they say about
exactly. Because there is a Quranic ayat I was about to quote, that the believers, the mu'mineen, are hard against the unbelievers, but compassionate amongst themselves.
Right. So, you know, I mean, I'm really impressed by what he's saying here. Yeah. When we and the oppressed peoples of the world are delighted to be the objects of criminal accusations.
Yes.
By the superpowers through their international mass media.
In a sense, I'm getting that Islamophobia thing, aren't we?
He's like, we're quite happy that you're doing this.
We're quite happy that you do this.
And unfortunately, I see a lot of Muslims, they're like, that's not good, whatever.
I don't want to say this and I don't want to quote that. No, this is the point. You know, I was going to say, I saw on the television this wonderful image where you see Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, along with a good friend, Desmond Tutu.
Yeah.
The Archbishop with a huge cross. I mean, I love Desmond Tutu. I mean, he really knows how to decorate himself. But he's got the huge cross right in front. And what's he doing? He's doing pilgrimage. He's doing ziyara, as we say, of Imam Khomeini. Desmond Tutu. That's the crux of what we're talking about. You see, I tell you, I used to have these debates with non-Muslims in my office when I used to work as an engineer.
Right.
And when I used to say the nitty-gritty, which I grasped from the Holy Imam, that, look, this is the reality of things, you know. I mean, you may not know this now, but you'll realize this later.
Right.
And they didn't like what I had to say. It doesn't go down well. I used to see the colors change in the face, you know.
Right.
One minute red, next minute white, you know.
Right.
But maybe that's just the way Anglo-Saxons look. I don't know.
Right.
But
or
blue, as it happens to be in Scotland.
As Billy Connolly
said. But at the end of the day, you know what they said? They said, you know, you're right to stick to what you know. It's right to stick to principle. And that's the thing. This is what we're talking about here, that if we understand the reality of what we believe, we stick to principle,
right,
things will come our way, they'll realize that we really stand for something that's important, something that's truth. Otherwise,
I mean, I think it just goes back to, I mean, it goes back to what we've been talking about in different programs, which is, do you believe the Quran or not?
Exactly.
Okay. I mean, like you said, you know, people reciting it parrot-wise and...
Singers of the Quran.
That's, you know, we don't want that.
We don't want that.
We want somebody, and again, this is first addressed to ourselves, who, when they read about a promise, a divine promise in the Quran,
they believe it. Yes, because Allah said it. I believe Allah.
Okay, this is the problem. Yeah. This is the problem. We want to believe, or we, you know, it makes us feel emotionally good when we hear this.
Mm.
But then when we're faced with these issues...
Issues, yes.
On a real...
Reality basis, right, yes.
Whether it's as an individual or whether it's as a government or as a government official.
Yes, as a government.
And then we think to ourselves, well, how is it that God could really... You know, the Americans, with all their power, they can do this and that.
That, yes.
I mean, I'm very upset because our dear foreign minister said something he shouldn't have said. And, you know, and he did apologize afterwards.
Did he?
Yes. Well,
I hadn't heard this.
He had to.
Okay.
He basically said that, you know, what are you talking about? They can destroy our, the Americans can destroy our, you know, anti-air.
System, defense system.
With one bomb. And, you know, this, I think, shows a poverty of understanding.
It does.
Of what's going on, because remember, at the time of the war,
And at the time when these, I know this is the will, but I just like to go back to the desert of
exactly. I mean, you know,
desert of Tabas. Right. Please remember that one.
The point is that
where the Quranic verse of Surah Fil was recited, and I remember that it went through every mosque all over the world. That what happened in the desert of Tabas was like Surah Fil. End of story.
Right, and my point is this.
Yes.
Whether you know Surah Fil or you don't.
Don't, yes.
Or whether you're able to.
Sorry, I meant the chapter of the elephant.
Exactly. And I'm simply saying that, you know, you have to understand that there is two schools. One is relying on divine assistance.
Exactly. Solely.
Right. And the other school is relying on other than that. Whatever that other thing is. Whether it's your own, you know, thinking that you yourself can do things, whether it's, you know, whoever is going to help you, this nation, that nation.
Well, this is where I love that in the Quran, when I read that.
And these are the only two options.
Yes.
As a Muslim, right, this is my point, a Muslim, you have to believe in divine assistance. Otherwise, you don't really understand what you're doing.
Exactly, because what I was going to say was, and this is what you see in the Quran over and over again, Allah says, do you believe me when I make my promise to you that I will reward you both in this world and in the hereafter? Or have you decided in your heart of heart that you have other gods beside me?
Right. So the point is, it's not even about rational versus irrational, because they always come back and they say, well, you got to look at things rationally.
Rationally, yes.
This is the way the world is.
Yes, practically. Yes.
And the point is really this. Okay, if somebody from the beginning doesn't believe in God, yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Very rational.
Very rational.
You look at the material facts, so to speak, as they say, empirical analysis.
Yes.
And done.
Yes, you're thinking of your pocket and your stomach.
Now, the interesting thing is that empirical evidence proves that even relying on empirical evidence is not always reliable.
No, because we've got crises all over the place.
It's that thing you were talking about, which is, you as an engineer, you do simulations where, hey, suddenly...
Thank you.
I think it's called black swan.
Yes.
It's called the black swan. In economics, they call it black swan.
It's a black swan,
which
right,
is that, you know, an event that there was no way of predicting.
No way of predicting.
Just like, you know, it's very rare to have a black swan.
Oh, and it's, you know, very rare to have a 500-mile-an-hour wind, but you may get it and your bridge disappears.
Right. Yes. So the point is that even if you just, you know, there's a limit.
Yes,
doesn't mean
limit.
You shouldn't do empirical analysis. Nobody's against empirical analysis.
No, nobody's
against science.
No.
Right?
We invented it, actually.
Yeah, and remember, we bring down the drones.
We bring down the drones.
With science.
Yes, it's science.
Right?
Yes, thank you.
The point is that a step before that, or if you want to put it that way, this is happening within a larger context, which is the will of God.
Exactly.
Okay. So, at some point, you have to, with yourself, in your own heart, decide which one it is.
And this is what was the greatness of the Imam, wasn't it? May God bless his soul, Imam Khomeini, that he was completely and utterly devoted to Allah himself. And that's what's reflecting in his
complete tawakkul.
He's saying, look, forget about all this. This is just an illusion. You're deluding yourself by looking at
it. And it's a problem because you end up doing things that you shouldn't have done.
Because you'll be mushrik. You'll become...
You'll do things that won't be in your benefit.
No.
I'm talking about personal benefit.
Personal benefit even, yes.
Okay? Don't rely on these tawud.
No.
Okay? If they're saying things about you,
Who cares?
You know, like Supreme Leader says, don't let their smile or their
frowns
deceive you. So what? They're smiling? They're frowning?
But I love the fact that the Rahbar, the Supreme Leader, did say that it's nice to have the experience.
He says, this too will be an experience.
This too.
Okay.
Right.
So, I think...
Yes, just to round off this particular session.
I think
those things
that we read, one, it was an issue of unity.
Unity, yes.
And how
number
it is
one.
Through the Saudis and through the Wahhabis and through the distortions of Islam. And through, you know, using people who appear to be Islamic.
Yes. To divide people.
To divide and to destroy Islam.
Islam, yes. Because the Holy Quran says that. Hold firm onto the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This unity, this is our power.
So let's not be fooled by anybody in Saudi Arabia and all these guys.
No. And I hope
their goal is to get rid of Islam. And the only reason Ali Saud supports Islam is so that they can maintain their own family rule.
Yes.
And no other reason.
Yes.
There is no other reason.
No.
Okay? The other thing he talks about is the fact that, you know, we should be happy that you have certain people who by nature are terrorists.
Yes.
I'm talking about governments.
Governments, yes, which is the U.S.
Right, and others.
Yes.
We should be proud of the fact that they are accusing us of things. Yes. Because that shows that, hey, we're doing it.
We're doing the right thing.
Right.
We're doing the right thing.
You really
thing.
Don't want these guys to praise you.
No.
Once they start praising you, you gotta look at yourself.
Yeah, you've got to really reflect on yourself that something's gone wrong.
And going on this path, this Sirat al-Mustaqim,
yes,
which, you know, prevents you from being mulhid. Mulhid being a person who denies God altogether.
Yes, atheist, yes.
Antitheist.
Yes.
Actually, I think a good translation is antitheist.
Antitheist, yes.
Okay. Mm. And then you have... You know, you won't go there, nor will you go to this kind of idolatrous, polytheist.
And
when we talk about polytheist, we're not talking about like, you know, gods,
like
statues.
It's like taking them for a god.
It's taking your own nafs, your own desires.
Yes, and tying them with...
Your own desires as your god.
God.
Yes, because isn't this really the characteristics of Islam, of Western civilization?
Of course it is.
Is that your desire is your god.
Is your god.
And has to be... Serviced. Anyway, which way is necessary.
Exactly. On that note, Dr. Mehdi Tarabi, I thank you very much for your insight into the Imam's words. Of course, they still resonate deeply in our hearts. And we hope to stay on Sirat al-Mustaqim, the true path that Allah revealed for us in the Holy Quran. And, you know, really to read the Holy Quran and its message and take it on board for what it really is, the ultimate goal is for the salvation of man. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to thank you, sir, as well. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
The Land of a Thousand Islands.
Part 2.
F. After 300 years of colonization of Indonesia, the Dutch finally had to abandon the occupied lands because that was what the people of Indonesia wanted. Dr. Ahmad Sukarno had been involved in the nationalist activities since his puberty. He then spearheaded the movement for independence from the Netherlands. In 1945, Dr. Ahmad Sukarno announced his people's demand for independence, but the Dutch were not willing to give up 3 centuries of dominance over Indonesia's resources. Therefore, the people of Indonesia had to fight with the Dutch for 4 years to achieve their independence. Historical accounts refer to the 4-year war as savage. Just one example is enough to support this claim. In 1947, in the middle of the independence war, Dutch soldiers entered the village of Rawagied and killed 341 men and male children of the village before the eyes of their families. Dutch ambassador Tyr de Zouan took part in the 66th anniversary of the Rawagied massacre. He apologized to the families of the victims and said that he was not only there on behalf of his country's government, but also as a representative of the Dutch nation. After 4 years of unabated war, the United Nations finally stepped in and the Dutch government had to accept a new governmental system called the Netherlands-Indonesian Union, and the two sides signed a truce. Finally, in 1949, the two sides signed an agreement which stipulated that the entire land of Indonesia, except for New Guinea, be handed over to the interim government of the United States of Indonesia. On December 16, 1949, Dr. Ahmad Sukarno was elected as the president of the country. Contemporary cultural and societal ties between Iran and Indonesia date back to the 1960s and 70s. After years of break, the two sides resumed ties and Iran reopened its embassy in Indonesia. The resumption of diplomatic ties paved the way for the revival of trade and cultural interactions. Their Omidvar brothers might be the first Iranian tourists in Indonesia at those times. Isa and Abdullah Omidvar are Iranian world explorers who started their round-the-world expedition in the 1950s. The two brothers described as sensational the celebrations of Indonesia's independence and the 2-hour-long speech by then-President Ahmad Sukarno. The explorers said 10 years after the independence, Indonesians still would end their phone conversations with the word Merdeka, which means independence. 20 years later, in the 1950s, Iran sent a parliamentary delegation headed by then-Prime Minister Sharif Emami to Indonesia to take part in the celebrations of the 30th anniversary of the country's independence. Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution did not disrupt the two states' bilateral relations. In fact, the two sides have maintained their close ties at high levels. The presidents of the two nations exchanged official visits and signed memoranda of understanding. Most importantly, it seems that the Islamic Revolution has influenced the public in Indonesia. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Indonesian youth came to Iran for education and became acquainted with the Shiite school of thought. When they would return to their country, they would act as missionaries and promote this way of thinking among their people. That is why experts attribute the recent rise in the number of Shia Muslims in Indonesia to Iran. Today, Shiite Muslims account for around 5 million of the Muslim population in Indonesia. Now, what is the status of Shia Islam in modern-day Indonesia? President Abdurrahman Rahim, who succeeded General Suharto, headed the organization of Nahdlatul Ulama for a while. The organization was founded by his father. Ar-Rahim regarded himself as a cultural Shia and that he ran an organization with cultural preferences. Such a belief is still preserved by the incumbent leaders of the organization. This means that in addition to the concept of imamat, 12 imams, and other fundamental beliefs, most of the Islamic and ideological teachings in the organization follow the Shia doctrine. Most of the Sufi rituals, pilgrimages, and religious traditions practiced by religious traditionalists are mostly inclined towards Shia Islam. Whenever a person gets sick, a number of people pray for them and reach out to the five sacred members of the Prophet Muhammad's household, known as the Ahle Aba. Sunni Muslims still make vows and offer votive foods. There are written pilgrimage prayers inscribed on the tombs of the Sadat, which consist of the names of sacred figures in Shia Islam, such as that of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, Hazrat Zahra, Imam Hassan, and Imam Hussein, peace be upon them. This attests to the fact that Twelver Shia did exist in Indonesia and that Shia Islam lives on in the country. Indonesia is the most populated Muslim country. This is why it attracts significant attention from the world and Muslim countries. In addition to Iran, Saudi Arabia is also seeking to promote its ideology in Indonesia. Wahhabism, which is not congruent with the peaceful nature of the people of Indonesia. Al Saud's activities in Indonesia stretch back to the early 1970s. They launched several Salafi organizations and a number of moderate movements in Indonesia to promote the Hanbali school of jurisprudence in parallel with the Al-Shafi'i school. In the 1970s and 80s, Saudi Arabia published Wahhabi books in Indonesia with low prices. General Suharto became Indonesia's president in 1967 after he led a coup against his predecessor, Ahmad Sukarno. Besides the Indonesian graduates in Saudi Arabia, commentators believe Suharto also played an effective role in the promotion of Wahhabism in Indonesia. They founded Wahhabi centers in Indonesia, which are still operating in the country. The emergence of extremist attitudes towards the followers of other religions and denominations can be linked to efforts by Wahhabi groups in the country. In one particular incident, a leader of congressional prayer of a Wahhabi mosque ordered the expulsion of Shia Muslims and the destruction of their properties. Following this violent order, thousands of men, women, and children were forced to leave the city after their houses were burnt down. In another incident, a crowd set fire to a church while chanting Allah is great and razed it to the ground. The emergence of extremist ideologies has created discord among the people of Indonesia and has led to extremist Muslims committing acts of violence against Christians of Indonesia. However, the moral people of Indonesia do not accept such a violent way of thinking. It's the last days of the holy month of Ramadan. Eid al-Fitr is around the corner. Decorations can be seen in four corners of the city to usher in the occasion. All Muslims try their best to get the necessary items to celebrate the festivity. The city is brimming with colors, joy, and happiness. With the sighting of the new moon, the celebrations of Eid al-Fitr get started. Eid Fetch is the most important festivity in Indonesia. On the occasion, families dress in the same colors and head to mosques to perform Idul Fitr prayer. This harmony in dressing represents unity. After Idul Fitr prayer, it's time for family visits. On Idul Fitr, everyone is smiling. The people of Indonesia are renowned for being smiley. Here you can always see rows of white teeth, which are not willing to hide behind the lips. Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, and Shia and Sunni Muslims all live together peacefully in this green country. They enjoy their coexistence. They are used to getting together on any occasion and trying to be happy all the time. And of course, everywhere in the country, there are entertainment venues providing happy times for people. It seems that the peaceful people of Indonesia are neither interested in violence, nor do they tolerate the Salafis' deviant way of thinking and their acts of killing. Indonesia is a country with 17,000 islands, with a beautiful nature. It acts as a bridge between Asia and Oceania. Centuries of colonization in the country have not diminished the Indonesians' love for Islam. This is Indonesia, the land of smiling Islam.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. This is the month of Muharram. We would like to offer our condolences to you here at IRIB English Radio. We would like to offer our condolences to you in this most grave and sacred month on the demise of the Doyen of the Martyrs, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Today we're going to be addressing a question that is very important, and that is this. We usually think of Yazid as having committed one major crime in his reign and his government, and that was the martyrdom and the killing of Imam Hussein and his family. A question arises, did Yazid commit other crimes as well or not? The answer to this question is that in his small reign and his government, Yazid committed a number of crimes, but the most important of these are three. First of all, the gravest and the most significant crime that he committed was, of course, the killing of Imam Hussein, the murder of Imam Hussein and his companions and his family, and also the the imprisonment of his children and his wives and his daughters. Aside from this, there are also two other events and two other things that he did which are also of significance and are very heinous crimes. One of these is the killing of the people of Medina. This occurred approximately 2 years after the event of Karbala. In this occasion, Yazid killed a large number of people from the city of Medina. This event is known as the event of Harra. Aside from this, there's another significant event that happened, which Yazid was responsible for, and that was that Yazid set the house of God, the Kaaba, on fire. Approximately 1 year after the killing of the people of Medina, which you just mentioned, in a battle with Abdullah ibn Zubair in the secret mosque, Abdullah ibn Zubair had taken refuge in the sacred mosque in Masjid al-Haram, and of course he was opposed to Yazid and his government. So Yazid attacked the sacred mosque, and using catapults, he attempted to draw Abdullah ibn Zubair out of there, and in this process, the house of God was set on fire. This continued until finally the news of the death of Yazid the news of the death of Yazid reached the people, and it was announced that he had died due to an intense session of wine drinking and intoxication. So these are some of the most significant crimes and heinous crimes of Yazid. All of them are unequal. All of them are grave and heinous. Of course, the most heinous and the most disgusting of these, obviously, is the murder of Imam Hussein and his companions. But all of these should be also taken into consideration. But we want to assess the crimes and the things that he had committed. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the crimes of Yazid. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio again is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Our topic today is a relevant topic because we are now nearing the month of Muharram. Our topic today is a very time-relevant topic today, and also perhaps a misconception. And the question is as follows. Why do us Muslims, Shia Muslims specifically, start the mourning for the grandson of the Prophet Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam as soon as the month of Muharram starts? Seeing that the Imam was killed on the 10th day of Muharram, why do we start so early is the question. Dear Sheikh, please enlighten us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me also express my condolences to the Imam of the time and all the listeners for this sad occasion of the month of Muharram. And may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala include us among the true followers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So the first point is that, this is a matter of history. Something has happened about 14 centuries ago, and we can mourn for that any time in the year. That is why you see that for many religious occasions, one of the common recommended deeds is reciting the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So it's not happening every day. I mean, it's not Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is not killed every year on the 10th of Muharram. He was martyred in the 61 after Hijrah. So we should not think that we need to wait for the 10th of Muharram for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to be killed and then we begin mourning.
Only then we start crying.
Yeah. So already we know that it has happened in the past. This is the first point. The second point is that when we refer to the seerah and conduct of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, we see that they also did the same. And as soon as the month of Muharram, started, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, we have specifically about some of the Imams, like Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, they did not laugh. They showed a kind of sadness. And it culminated on the day of Ashura, the 10th of Muharram. For example, Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam is quoted as saying, as soon as the month of Muharram began, my father, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, he was always sad. We never saw him happy. And on the 10th of Muharram, he was, crying and mourning the whole day. And used to say that this is the day when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was martyred. The next point is that many years before the birth of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the previous prophets, our prophet, and Imam Hadi alayhi salam, they have cried for the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which means that it's not a matter of the 10th of Muharram only. It's a culture, it's a message. To the extent that the previous prophets, they have also cried for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So our Holy Prophet, according to narrations in both Shia and Sunni sources, in different occasions, he cried for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam many years, even before the...
advance, actually.
Yeah, and the event of Ashura taking place. Imam Ali alayhi salam, according to some narration passed by Karbala, and he cried for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Which means that, as I mentioned, it's not limited to the 10th of Muharram. I don't want to say that on a daily basis we need to cry for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, but the point is that, we should not think that this event is a simple one, insignificant, has happened on the 10th of Muharram 61, and we need to cry only on that very specific day. No.
So we should convey how significant this event, the greatest tragedy of all time, conduct and demeanor,
mm-hmm.
and not celebrating maybe as usual, laughing as much as usual.
And beyond that, we have the understanding of the message of the uprising of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So it's not only a matter of crying and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And the other issue is that the next philosophy for the fact that people, the Shia, their custom is to begin mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam from the 1st of Muharram is that people have enough time to contemplate about the reasons, the philosophies of this uprising. We know that it went through different stages. First, Imam Hussein alayhi salam went from Medina to Mecca. So what was the reason? Then from Mecca to Iraq, he was stopped, in the middle of the way, why Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam chose the city of Kufa. So if we are going to only dedicate one day for mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the day of Ashura, people have they do not have enough time, and the day of Ashura, people are mainly engaged in crying and thinking about the
mourning ceremony,
emotional aspect of this event. But when it comes to understanding, we need some time.
And this is actually ties in with that, with these 9 days preceding this 10th day, we have time for lectures and to enlighten ourselves on who this imam actually was and what he stood for.
And so it's a good opportunity for the Shia, at least for 10 days, to take part in these ceremonies, in these sessions for mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Alhamdulillah, in all the places, in most of the places, the in Shia communities, we have scholars talking about the philosophy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam's uprising. So it gives the people another dimension. It's not only about emotions, it's also about the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam,
philosophy
right? And philosophy of his uprising. And 10 days at least is a good opportunity for the people to know about that. The other point is that to even refer to the history, according to the authentic reports, Imam Hussein alayhi salam reached the land of Karbala or Nineveh on the 2nd of Muharram. And we can argue that the tragedy of Karbala somehow began from that very day, I mean the 2nd of Muharram. So it's also logical to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam in these at least 9 days, because...
Makes sense.
Yeah, the day that Imam Hussein alayhi salam reached this land was the 2nd of Muharram. The other point is that the reason, according to some scholars, is to somehow revive the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Let me give you one example.
Please do.
It's been mentioned that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he made a wasiya, a will, that for 10 days after his martyrdom, people come on the day of Arafah, come and mourn for Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. This is very interesting. Maybe many of our dear listeners have not heard about this narration. Let me repeat that. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says that he's not talking about the date of his martyrdom. He says that every day, every year, for 10 years after my martyrdom, so first of all, he's telling the Shia that I will be martyred. He says that for 10 years after my martyrdom, come and mourn for me on the day of Arafah, in the land of Arafat. Which means that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he doesn't say that mourn for me on the day that I was martyred. No, on the day of Arafah in this land. Why? Because in this very important day, many Muslims, maybe thousands of Muslims, are going to gather in this very specific time and place. And when Shia are going to mourn for Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, they come and ask, what is the reason why in this place? Why? Who are you talking about?
So to spread the message and this information.
Exactly. So it's very interesting that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam mentions a day which is irrelevant to the date of his martyrdom. It's another day. But the importance of that day and that place is that many of the people are present.
It's a huge gathering.
So it means that one of the philosophies for mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is also to revive the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And we cannot only limit it to one day. One of the opportunities is these at least first 10 days of the month of Muharram. Another issue is that some of the, I've seen this point, which is very profound point, that some of the scholars believe that we begin mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam from the 1st of Muharram to gradually get prepared for that great event of Ashura. So all at once, we cannot go to the day of Ashura and remember all those calamities and afflictions, martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his family members and companions. Right. So we need a kind of preparation.
You need to process this gradually.
Exactly. So for the first night, for the second night, gradually we get prepared for that greatest tragedy, which is the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This is the famous narration of the Prophet that in Liqatil al-Hussein alayhi salam, حرارة في قلوب المؤمنين لا تبرد أبدا or لن